It's time for the VolQuest Mailbag Podcast, answering your questions from the General's Quarters every week, right here on VolQuest.
Hey, good Thursday morning, everybody. This is the VolQuest Mailbag Podcast, presented by our friends over at Exterior Home Solutions, 865-524-5888. Get a free estimate by dialing that phone number, again, 865-524-5888, online at exteriorhomesolutions.com. They've been number one in East Tennessee since 1999 for roofing, siding, garage, windows, all that and more. That is Exterior Home Solutions. Got a lot of questions to get into, some on Tennessee football, spring practice coming up, Tennessee basketball happening right now, Tennessee baseball started, recruiting never stops. Let's start with B-Bear 1998. What's the story with Ricky? Ricky Gibson, of course, the report earlier this week, Brent, that he's going to enter the transfer portal.
Welcome to college football. You know, welcome to why coaches hate the two portal windows instead of the one portal window. There's nothing Ricky Gibson's doing that's wrong or not within his rights. This is the frustration that fans are growing with college athletics and that coaches have with college athletics. And big picture, I mean, the hard part about this, and I said this in a post, I think, on a message board, Grant, is and Eric chime in here too. I think the frustrating part for fans, and this is where college athletics has got to be careful, in my opinion. A lot of these meetings that are high profile, it's being talked about, everything that comes out of the meeting is how much more money are we going to make? How much more money are we going to make? Well, more TV money, more this here. We're going to expand the playoffs, change this, make more money here. Where's somebody who's meeting to say, let's make sure the game's sound. Let's make sure the game is good. Let's fix some things that are harmful, that are a detriment potentially to the game, and fix that. You know, we've got this whole house settlement potentially coming down the pike, and there's this arm out there that is a non-NCAA group who are supposed to validate, for lack of better words, NIL deals, right? Every kid has to report their NIL deal. Every school has to report the NIL deal, and it can't be just a booster giving a check. It's got to be legitimate name, image, likeness, which everybody's been a big fan of. Well, this week, the state of Oregon is putting a bill in front of their state legislature that says student-athletes in their state don't have to report NIL deals to anybody. It's illegal for them to have to do that. So they're one step ahead of what's potentially coming with the house settlement. Those are the type of things that I think are really frustrating for fans out there, and it's putting a strain on the fandom of college athletics right now.
I don't know how you fix it. I don't begin to know how you fix it, but I think at some point it's got to get to a multi-year contract era where players are held to something, because if not, it's just constantly renegotiating their deals. And I'm not trying to limit player movement or anything like that, but the money question, the money aspect of it, how much money is enough? It's never going to be answered until you have some kind of contract, some kind of deal in place where it's not just a year-over-year renegotiation, because Ricky Gibson is far from the first player to do this. He's not the last player who's going to do this. A lot of this happens behind the scenes, and you just never hear about it. These players want more money. They have a little bit bigger piece of the pie year over year, and they want a new deal, and they get it done behind the closed doors, and nobody ever hears a word about it. So I don't know how you fix any of it until you fix the players being held to something contractually. And I don't know how you get to that if that's just straight up pay for play, and it's an NFL model, and go from there. But I mean, I've said it 100 times in the past, like NFL players would do the same thing if they had the rights that college football players have in terms of year-over-year contracts, and every year you're entering free agency and you can just go to the highest bidder. I mean, that's what they would do as well. So until you get a grasp on that, a handle on that, I don't know how you go about fixing anything else that goes with the game.
As far as Tennessee's concerned, Brent, and I know you put a note about this on the board, just kind of your thoughts. I mean, from the it's never as easy as it sounds, right? But from the outside, it's like you got to go pay the guy. You have no choice. Jermon McCoy's hurt. You're looking at, McMurray and maybe an underclassman, maybe a late get from the portal, maybe a freshman kind of starting there until, you know, McCoy gets back if you lose Ricky Gibson. So from the outside looking in, it's like, go get that done. Go pay him. However, you know, what's that set in the locker room if you go and renegotiate a deal and all this next player has to do is put it out there on Twitter and see what he gets? It's a tricky business, but certainly this is a guy that Tennessee absolutely needs. So, again, I'm really intrigued to see how they play this, because from the outside looking in, it's like you got to go pay that guy because you can't afford to lose him.
Well, and Ricky Gibson's people made the play, obviously, to make it public.
Yeah.
Instead of, you know, trying to work something behind the scenes here, you know, they've made a play to make this public. And so if Ricky Gibson stays, everybody's going to know Ricky Gibson got a new deal. Regardless of whether they know the details of the deal, they know he got a new deal. So do other people over the next month say, hey, I want a new deal. You know, I need a new deal. He got a new deal. I'll get a new deal. I'm valuable. You know, I mean, you got to have me. And I think that's the hard part right now. And that's why I'm with you, Grant. I think you gotta put some kind of multi-year deal. I think we're still a ways away from that being the case. I mean, I do, you know, maybe they're employees at some point. I don't know what it is, but at some point there's got to be some, you can have freedom of movement, but there's some cost to having the freedom of movement, buyout or whatever the case may be. I think in the short term, and coaches have been advocating for this spring window, you got to have one window for transfer. You've got to have one open season for a transfer. Football's, I mean, I guess, does baseball have split? Do they have two transfer portal windows in baseball?
Yes, there's a winter transfer portal window, but nobody knows about it.
Yeah, okay. It's not used, right?
It is going to be used heavily moving forward with the roster restrictions. But yes, okay. There is.
So, I mean, I just think you got to try to get to one portal window so that you don't have players getting a deal in the winter window and then coming back and getting another new deal in the spring window when they haven't played anymore, haven't done anything. I mean, I think from a coach's standpoint, you're trying to set your roster. You know, I mean, I think Lane Kiffin did this last year at Ole Miss to some degree. I don't know if it's as significant as some people alluded to. They didn't do a lot of 11-on-11 work in spring ball because he didn't want anybody to think where they were on the depth chart, because he didn't know who was going to go in the spring portal. So we're just going to do more individual drills, you know, and less 11-on-11, because I don't want somebody thinking he's third team or he's second team and he's going to go into the portal on me. Okay, that's not development. That's not helping your team get better if you're if you're worried so much about what might happen in April in terms of of keeping your roster together. So I think we got to look in football at eliminating the second portal window and making it one portal window at some point in time in the year. And I don't know when that is, but I think that is a realistic fix that you can do something quickly that would negate some of this going on, because I think this is only going to continue, right? I mean,
why wouldn't it? Yeah.
I mean, you know, why wouldn't somebody come back and say, hey, I've got leverage here. Give me a new deal. You got to have me, you know, I don't know.
I think you could do it at some point in January and maybe into early February. I mean, as college basketball is far from perfect in this same conversation, but in college basketball, you know, April is going to be insane with roster turnover. There's going to be a ton of kids enter the portal and all that stuff. And then it feels like May, you start to put your pieces together, figure out what kind of team you're going to have. And then everybody's on campus in June, July, into the early fall and working together on the court, and you kind of feel like you know what this team is and you're trying to figure out how the pieces all fit together. At least you know what you have in college basketball in June. If there was a July college basketball window, it would be the same thing as this spring college football window, where you're making progress in the offseason and then all of a sudden, boom, you're right back in the point where you're trying to figure out what your roster is going to look like. So, yeah, I agree. One window would be in the short term, because the other stuff – down the road is going to take so much more to reach, like contracts and
CBA.
CBA player union, all that stuff. Like, how are they going to lead it? Who's going to found it? All that stuff. Like, that's years down the road. So you better find a quick fix now.
Yeah. I mean, and again, with late drop ads, I mean, you could make that window January the 2nd through January the 14th. You know,
I wasn't thinking about the academic schedule.
Because why would you, right? I mean, you get a kid into school.
Rand's here for ball, not for books.
Yeah, we didn't come here to play school.
That's right. So, I mean, if you did that, then it would still affect some teams in the playoff. They would have to deal with it. But, I mean, what sport do you know that in the middle of their playoff run holds the draft and free agency all at the same time? And that's where college football is right now.
Yeah.
That's what December is. We're going to draft your team. We're going to have free agency. Oh, and go try to win a championship all at the same time.
And people say head coaches make too much money. I don't make enough. I don't want to deal with all that crap. And while you're at it, let's get rid of the unlimited transfer. I'm just going to – anytime I can throw that in there. I think that's the worst thing ever in college football. Vulcan, got a couple here. If you had to add one player not named Dalton Connect from last year's Tennessee basketball team to this year's team for the March Madness run, who would it be?
Tobey Awaka, probably. Jonas Adu, obviously, no disrespect to Jonas Adu. He is a all-SEC player, and he was a really good piece at Tennessee last season. And you'd love to have him back, but you kind of already have that body in Felix Akpar, and I don't know how much time you get those two on the court at the same time. I think if you could combine those two players, I've said before, I think you could have a lottery pick if you could combine the Jonas and Felix skill sets in terms of physicality from Felix and blocking shots and rebounding and then the touch from Jonas. But Tobey with JP Estrella out, I think that's the guy that you'd want to have that extra body in the paint. And he's had a good year at Arizona. He's had some double-doubles and has played well there for a good basketball team. Maybe Josiah Jordan James is somebody you'd want back because he did a little bit of everything. He's very versatile. But with JP's injury, I think you'd want somebody like Tobey back.
David Keith fan, a couple of baseball questions. Is the baseball pitching plan this weekend the same? Doyle game one, Phillips game two, and see where they are on Sunday? Yes, Tony confirmed that Tuesday night. Phillips the second game, Doyle first game, and we'll kind of see what happens on Sunday. When SEC baseball season weekends start, are we going to have an everyday first baseman, or will it be Coach V still matching pieces based on the lineup? That's up to the players. I know that's a very, very coach-speak answer, but that's what Tony says all the time. Players make the lineup, and I mean, eventually, yes. I mean, this happens all the time. Tinkering, putting this guy here, mixing things up, and then you settle. I mean, 2023, they settled on Christian Scott was their right fielder. Hunter Ensley was your center fielder. I mean, eventually they will settle. Now, I'm not to say that, you know, every now and again, you know, you might want to go lefty-righty. You know, we'll see what the what happens with Alberto Ozuna. I mean, he's a right-handed bat. That's something Tennessee wants in that lineup there, especially if you're facing a southpaw. So, based on matchup, I can see some things changing a little bit. But to answer your question, yeah, like, they're going to fall into an everyday lineup eventually. But, you know, it's going to take a little bit of time, and it's not going to happen this weekend. And hopefully, you know, it might happen by the time Florida comes to town, but it might be a little bit after that.
Hey, Eric, how excited are you for this weekend where it's not the Oprah Winfrey, everybody gets to face a batter pitching rotation for Tony Vitello's team?
Yeah, I'm pumped. 11 pitchers on Tuesday night was not fun, especially when some of us, you know, some of us had to work the basketball game. Others, like myself, just wanted to get home and watch it. I'm pumped to watch some good baseball, and I think Friday night's going to be a really, really good one down there. Plus, I've never been to Minute Maid Park. I know it's not called that anymore, but I'm going to refer to it as Minute Maid Park the entire weekend because, you know, that's just what it is.
Jorge Soler Park.
Yeah, Jorge Soler Park. Yes, that's a good point. Let's see here. What one player on offense, what one player on defense would you like to see have the biggest jump this fall, not named Nico? Brent?
You know, I pick a receiver. I mean, whether that's Mike Matthews or Chris Brazel, I mean, I'm going receiver on offense. And then I think defensively, it's probably got to be Jalen McMurray at corner, but because of need. I mean, you know, where are you going to be? I don't know when McCoy's going to be back. Now we got the Ricky Gibson situation there. I mean, McMurray was going to be the corner opposite of Ricky Gibson, in my opinion, until McCoy got back. Now he may be cornerback one for you at this point. So I think he's a guy who's got to take a real step for Tennessee because he's going to be put, you know, he's going to be put in some tough situations. And I mean, he played a good bit last year, but he's going to be asked to do a lot more this year than he even did last year.
Get out of my head, Hubbard, because I literally was thinking, name your receiver. And Mike Matthews is the first name that probably pops in your head. Brazel is another guy too, though. Defensively, before the Ricky Gibson stuff, or I guess corner is more apparent there after the Ricky Gibson headlines, one of your linebackers, and I don't think making a big jump means you weren't good previously. It just means you could be better. And those young guys have been young guys. They've looked like young guys at times. So if one of those guys can step up and be a man in the middle of that defense, that'd be huge.
Lance Hurd offensively, got to take a step.
That's a good one.
Yep.
And then to be different, I like the cornerback conversation, but give me a safety, right? I mean, yeah. Like Will Brooks is pretty, you know, pretty productive last year. But you need more from, I mean, pick your poison, Turrentine, Jacoby Thomas. I'm going to go with Idris Farouk. Didn't play an awful lot last year. Got his toes wet a little bit. Hopefully he can step up and you know, be a guy for him back there. So Hurd and Idris Farouk.
Well, and I think you could also throw a Davin Hobbs in there. I mean, I think Hobbs had a nice year last year, but there's no Omar Norman Lott. There's no Amari Thomas. Suddenly now Davin Hobbs is going to have to play even more snaps and be even more productive. So, I mean, there's a variety of guys that certainly jump into that. I think Hurd and the receiver are the two most obvious on offense. Defense is a little more, you know, debatable, but I think receiver and Hurd at tackle are the two most obvious right now.
And he's going to be limited in spring, right?
Yes.
You know, with the shoulder, he's one of those guys that's typically
Hobbs
always.
Yeah. You're talking about Hobbs, yeah.
ZGS Vols, do you foresee UT ditching the orange and white game down the road? Brent, it's a hot topic in college football right now. You're seeing more and more do it. Texas this week announced that they're going to do away with it.
And Alabama said they're going to do some kind of event, I think is how Kalen DeBoer described it. For the A-Day game, it would be an event of some kind. Yeah, I mean, I think these things are going away. Now, I think the question that you have to look at is what kind of event do you produce? Do you have a title sponsor for your game? How big of a contract deal financially is that? Money is important. All of that's there. But there's not a coach in college football, Grant Ramey, that has any interest in playing a spring game. I don't know that there's a player on a roster that has much interest in playing a spring game other than maybe a walk-on guy.
And college football is one person does it, then everybody else is going to do it.
The biggest copycat deal in the world.
And the fact that the number of teams that have so far already gone away from the spring game format is just a sign that everybody's going to do it at some point. It's just a matter of what can you come up with to replace it, and how does your event compare to everybody else's event, and how can you make money off of it? How can you give the fans something, some kind of experience in place of that? I mean, let's be honest, the spring games for a long time have not been really anything other than a chance just to go to the stadium and sit there and kind of see some guys. But other than that, they're really nothing. So it's not like you're trying to replace something that's going to be difficult to replace. You just got to get creative with it and figure out a way to do that.
It's very vanilla. But, I mean, even for us guys, I mean, I remember seeing Nico rolling out, you know, hitting Ethan Davis there on the run a couple of springs ago. That was a huge takeaway for me, seeing Ethan Davis that year. You still get to see some players that you haven't seen play before or a lot. And even, I mean, just for the fan in general, just getting back into the stadium and the pageantry and all that. Because, I mean, I've had a lot of people reach out to me this week because I've talked about it on Locked On Vols. And I mean, I get all that. But also, on the flip side, if you do away with it, can we all agree, can we please not do what Ole Miss did last year with like a tug of war and a slam dunk competition and
have you seen the Pro Bowl
contest?
You seen the Pro Bowl in recent years? That's what it is.
No, I have not, because it's trash. So
because it's unwatchable. I think fans would enjoy just watching an open practice, and you can avoid 11-on-11. You can avoid team stuff and just do 2 hours worth of individual drills and let fans kind of see how these individual coaches work and go through stuff with their players would be something interesting to see, and have it at the stadium, so you have a chance to get back in the stadium in the spring and enjoy an afternoon or whatever.
No, you're exactly right. What they did in the COVID year, I think would be perfect. We all just went up there and set in the stadium and watched. I mean, I got a lot out of that. So yeah, right. I mean, I agree with that. Thirsty Turtle, if the SEC and Big Ten do a regular season matchup in football, do you think the games will be randomly selected, or would they match the same caliber of teams against one another?
That much money on the line, there's going to be nothing random about it. If it's anything like a college basketball agreement between two conferences, it's going to be a TV deal where they're going to try to put the best matchups on the field. I mean, Auburn went to Duke in November, whenever the ACC-SEC challenge is, because those are the two best teams in college basketball, and that's what they wanted to see. So I think if it's anything like that, it's going to be a TV deal where you're not going to get to pick your partner. Somebody's going to pick it for you. But I could be wrong there.
I tend to agree with you. The more I look at this thing, the more I tend to think that I'm not sure this deal ever happens. I mean, it's for the fans, it sounds great. For TV, it sounds great. But getting both conferences, leadership, coaches, ADs, commissioners, everybody on board with something like this, I think is hard. And so we'll see. I mean, you're going to have to throw an astronomical amount of money out there to make that thing really go that way. So I'm a little skeptical. That's my weekly skepticism in the podcast, Eric Kane. I just have a hard time seeing that one come about.
I mean, if you're hesitating to even add a ninth SEC game, and you can't come to an agreement there, why are you going to be suddenly gung-ho to jump in with another conference, a power conference, and add another tough game to the schedule?
I agree. I mean, we'll see. I mean, I think you're going to go to nine because I think money's going to make you know, is going to be too much. And the Big Ten, if they're going to have the same power as the SEC in terms of dictating the playoffs, I think you're going to have to get to the same number of conference games in those two leagues. But I just don't know about that challenge.
UT Chuck 54, please explain why we go out and recruit a bunch of 5 and 4 stars and the next year they're not good enough to play. Is it just not the right fit, bad evaluation, or is it coaching? Really, before the NIL days, these type of kids were a bloodline of college football. What really has changed? Now 3-star players are more valuable than those other kids.
Yeah, I'm not really sure, I mean, what he's talking about here. You know, Tennessee's before NIL, they weren't, I mean, everybody wasn't starting freshman 5-stars. They're probably playing younger players now in the world of NIL, because if you don't, you're going to lose them. I don't think that part's changed. I think the nature grand of coaches is older veterans make them more comfortable. I think you're seeing that in college basketball right now. I think that's become even more comfortable through the COVID era with all the extra years guys got with COVID years. But I think in football terms, if you're going to spend money, NIL money, to sign a class, then you're going to have to become a younger team, because you got to play those people you've invested in to get to campus. If you're doing more NIL money after they kind of proved it on campus, or you're doing it through the portal, then you may be an older team. But I think regardless of stars, the more money you invest to get kids to sign out of high school, then the more you're going to, then the younger your team is going to typically be, or should be, year in and year out.
Rick Pitino said last week, and he's doubled down on it since then, that he's not recruiting high school players in this cycle because he's losing 3 veterans and he can't replace those 3 veterans with freshmen and expect to continue at the pace that St. John's is currently playing at. So I think that's part of it for a lot of coaches, is you would rather have those veterans and those guys that have been through it a little bit, and the portal changes that a little bit. But I think it's a case-by-case basis. Why does this player not play, or why does that player not play? It's probably a pretty good explanation from a coach if you could get it out of him as to why those players aren't playing and what's going on in those situations. I think it comes down to trust. You put the guys you feel on the field that you trust, and that's usually the veteran, the older guys, and that's the way it seems to play out more often than not.
Yeah, I think, too, you also have to look to your point, and Eric, you jump in here, too, but the point about case-by-case basis. I mean, how many people are, quote, a 5-star coming out of high school, and they get a big deal to come, and how satisfied are they? How much do they work compared to the 3-star guy who didn't get nearly as much to come out of high school, you know? And what's the culture in your program in terms of, you know, your mindset and your mentality? All those types of things factor in that make it more of a case-by-case basis than it is some blanket statement out there.
Or that guy that came from a small school who has never really been given anything and had to work his way up the ladder, and he's continuing that, and he's got some experience, too, to go with that work ethic.
Yeah, the chip on the shoulder guy's dangerous for sure. Volunteer at 87, true or false? Igor is the biggest piece for a March Madness run. Feels like you know what you're going to get with the other starters and Gainey. Him opening up the lane by hitting threes and being a presence on the boards and defensively gives this team an extra dimension.
I think you could say true and false. Igor has not played well the last couple of weeks, and Tennessee just went 4-1 over a 5-game stretch in which they had 4 road games. They won at Oklahoma. They won at LSU, they won at Texas A&M, and Igor has not played his best basketball during that stretch. I think this team feels like I've had this conversation with fans, multiple X factors. Like I know what I'm getting from Jordan Gainey night in and night out. Some nights he looks like an All-American, some nights he's struggling. You could say the same with Sakai Ziegler, first half or second half. You could say the same thing with Chaz when he's making shots or not making shots. Igor is a big piece of it, though, because he can rebound, he can score, he can assist, he can block, he can do a bunch of different stuff, and he's that guy. But it feels like Gainey's that guy, too. It feels like Sakai's that guy. It feels like Chaz is that guy. They're going to have a lot of different guys. I don't know which one is the biggest piece for that March run.
Another question here. In your view, has officiating gotten worse over the years, or does a combination of the two factors below make it seem that way? One, compared to 20 years ago, there is a platform to hear other grown men echo your frustrations with a bad call, Twitter. And two, 10 camera angles, more than that, in slow motion just highlight the misses more than it used to. Yeah, 100%. I think both of those things contribute in a major way. We just, there's more avenues to express our frustrations, and there's more ways to see the miscues by the officials. Brent, I'd love to have your comments on this. Do you think it's gotten worse, or do you think there's just too much exposure to now we always see the warts.
I think we've decided that everything has to be perfect. And now because of that, everything's under scrutiny because you can review every play seemingly. I think basketball's hurt themselves, Grant, because they've tried to be too perfect. I mean, that sport's had more missed calls than any other sport because of the pace of play that has been there for forever. You know, particularly when the shot clock came in, I think you're trying to be too perfect in that sport. I think it's over officiated in a lot of ways. There are too many rules, that are too many judgment things that's made it hard. And you throw in the camera angles as well.
Case in point, Grant, what time did the game get on actual television the other night?
It was after probably after the third media timeout, probably midway through the first half
About 10 minutes. It was like, and that's every game.
I know. And right. That's a problem.
Well, TV's got to fix that. I mean, TV's got to come to terms with the fact that basketball games are 2.5 hours, not 2 hour games.
I think they're fine with that because they want you to use ESPNU and ESPN News, and they want you to use the app when you can't find your game because this other game's running over. That's a different conversation for a different day. I think the two reasons listed are a perfect storm of officiating critiques. Now, I saw somebody, I can't remember who it was. It was on Twitter the other day, but it was a former Sports Illustrated writer because he tweeted a picture from an SI magazine in 1991 talking about officials missing calls, and he captioned it with something like, this is nothing new. Like, it's been happening for as long as everybody's been playing sports. But the replays and the how much you can slow it down, everything you can see, and the different angles and all that stuff. And then, yes, everybody having access to a publish button. And also, at the same time, I don't know how many elite officiating guys there are to pick from. Like, I don't know what the pool of candidates looks like that they have to go with. Like, do you really have that many guys to pick from? And could you replace these guys that aren't getting the job done? So I think it's all kind of a perfect storm.
Got plenty more questions to get into, but first let's get a word from Austin Price at Exterior Home Solutions. He couldn't make the podcast today, but he's here to tell you all about our friends at Exterior Home Solutions.
You know, life happens, and damage to your home can be extremely stressful. That's why it's important to find someone who offers efficient, quality work with financing options. Exterior Home Solutions, they value not only family, but community. And they're who I call when life happens, and you should too.
That phone number is 865-524-5888 or online at exteriorhomesolutions.com. Proud presenting sponsor of the show. Okay, let's jump back into the question. 731_V4L. Can you guys give us the scoop or more information on the latest Tennessee football commit, edge rusher C.J. Edwards?
Yeah, I think this is a situation where Tennessee evaluated him twice, saw him twice in January, really liked what they saw. Wanted to be early and out in front, didn't want to be late to the party on that one. Felt like they had an opportunity because they were early in the cycle in terms of jumping on that one. I think they feel like his stock's going to really rise and a bunch more offers are coming for him probably. But just a guy that they really liked. I think it's going to be interesting to see how much weight he puts on. Does he stay as a true Leo, or does he kind of become a Tyler Barron type player, a bigger guy who can play the strong side, opposite side, you know, from a physical standpoint, a size standpoint. But I think at the end of the day, this is a guy that Tennessee in their evaluation truly believed in. And I don't think he's gotten a ton of exposure, you know, in camp circuits and all those types of things. And I think there's a belief that his stock's going to really rise and Tennessee's going to benefit by being there early.
I think anytime you see your team, Tennessee, or whoever, you know, you're a fan of around the country, go out and get a non-ranked player, a three-star and all that, it's like, oh, why are we taking this guy and all that? But, I mean, the fact, Brent, you kind of pointed out there, the fact that they're doing this in February, I think it goes to show you how much they like this guy. And, like, he's probably going to be a fast riser in terms of the rankings and all that. And so if Rodney Gardner and Chop and all them wanted him in February, I think that says an awful lot. Sam Smith, 2233, has got a couple. Ramey or Robert, more likely the Fighting Oats sport coats come to town with a great offense and a defense that can give up 90 at any moment. Thoughts on this matchup?
My thoughts on the matchup, Alabama against Mississippi State Tuesday night, hit 22 three-point field goals. Tennessee at LSU Tuesday night made 23 field goals total. That's the difference in these two teams, like how they play. And that's not to say one's right and one's wrong. Alabama scored 100 and 11 points, I think, against Mississippi State. They gave up 110 at Missouri last week. That's kind of what Alabama is. Tennessee is going to have to be better at home to start basketball games. They got to be better to start basketball games in general. But at home, they were down 16 to Vanderbilt not too long ago. They were down 9 in the first half, 11 early in the second half against Missouri. So if you can't play around with Alabama like that and let Alabama get off to a fast start. So this is going to be have to be a Tennessee defensive clinic. You're the home team. You need to win this game. You need to protect your home court because there's a number one seed on the line. This is a direct competitor for that one of those number one seeds. Florida losing at Georgia helps you Tuesday night. But what does Tennessee do with it? And how does Tennessee come out and play? Tennessee has beat Alabama. They won in Tuscaloosa last year. They beat them 2 years ago when Alabama was number one, and they frustrated Mark Sears in that game. So it's going to be Chaz versus Mark Sears. It's going to be kind of the supporting cast for both teams. Behind those guys, it's going to be Felix versus Big Cliff down low. It's going to be really, really fun. Great atmosphere, I'm sure. It's going to be, can Tennessee's defense stifle that offense?
Well, Grant, would you take a loss if your team put up 94?
That's a great question for the General's Quarters to debate until the sun burns out.
Kane, what are we looking at to learn in Houston? Oklahoma State will be the test. The other two games are probably against non-NCAA tournament teams. We'll see about Arizona. Arizona was ranked inside the top 25 to begin the year by D1 Baseball. Obviously, they've got a pretty good track record with their baseball program. Oklahoma State's absolutely going to be the test. I haven't dove into the teams just yet, but, I mean, Rice will kind of be the one would assume kind of the easier contest on Saturday. Last question, what's the pitching plan for Sunday? We know Liam Dool is going to throw Friday. We know Marcus Phillips is going to throw Saturday. If A.J. Russell feels fine, I would open him on Sunday and do the same thing. If not, if they want to, you know, Tony certainly would not say that on Tuesday night. Kind of made it seem like maybe they'll wait a week and do it again on Tuesday, and that's fine, but if A.J. Russell is scheduled to throw in some capacity on Sunday, I would throw him in the game and I'd have him open and I would follow him with Arvidsson and, you know, whoever else. That's kind of what I would – Nate Snead, if he hasn't pitched, but I would assume that Nate Snead will have pitched at that point by the weekend. So,
how impressed are you with Russell getting back this early and throwing the way he threw to start that game on Tuesday? I mean, that seems pretty remarkable. To me, you hear about people ahead of schedule and rehabs, but this seems like significantly ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I mean, that internal brace has been an absolute game changer for the Tommy John surgery. And, you know, A.J. Russell's benefited from that in a massive way. And it expedited the timeline for him, and he was able to pick up a baseball earlier. And I've just been really, really impressed. And Tony kind of talked about it Tuesday night, saying, like, he wasn't big on the junk food and the bad things for your body and all that. But he cut everything out, and he was a psycho, as Tony Vitello described him, in attacking this and getting back onto the field. So I've been very impressed, really happy that he threw the ball super well. I mean, he hit 97 one time on the black, 96 a couple of times. Obviously, a little good striking out the side. The thing for him now is, okay, how does he feel today? How are you going to feel 2 days from now? Right. If you throw on Sunday or Tuesday, you know, how's that feel? And then building up from there. So been really impressed, and I'm happy that he was able to get back on the mound. Athron's got a couple. UCF AD accidentally sent out a bad PR email about taking season tickets away from current holders that have been selling them on secondary sites. It blew up in their face, and they had to get backtrack and apologize for the email. What are some of the craziest AD stunts that you've seen in your career that have backfired?
Oh, boy. Can of worms.
Yeah, you want to go first or you want me to go first?
I mean, what initially came to mind, I can remember where I was in my daughter's room putting her to bed. She was probably 3 years old, and Tennessee sent out the mass response to the FOIA over the 20 whatever year that was coaching search with John Curry and all that stuff that had all the texts and all the emails and all the, I mean, it was hundreds of pages of documents of just crazy detailed info. I mean, John Curry telling his boss he didn't have any Wi-Fi because he's on a Delta flight to the Pacific Northwest and there was no Wi-Fi on that plane or something. They couldn't find him. And I mean, just all that stuff. Mike Gundy text messages in that part of that, shaking loose in Dallas, all that stuff. Like, that whole moment in time was just insane.
Yeah, that whole search started off bad when John Curry tried to use John Gruden as a smokescreen to go hire his coach. And never put the Gruden stuff to bed. and let that fester. And John Gruden loved it festering out there. I mean, you know, he still talks about coaching in the college game, which he's not going to do. He was never going to coach in a college game. That thing started off bad and ended bad. And there's so many mistakes in that deal, you know, the Schiano deal and not having a better PR plan to sell that and then not sticking to your guns if that's who you wanted to hire. I mean, that's a case study in how not to do a lot of things from a search standpoint. The other one that stands out that backfired was Dave Hart's decision to eliminate the Lady Ball logo. That was a fight that just wasn't worth fighting. And that was a fight that he went out and started that he didn't need to start. He wasn't going to, I mean, even if he won it, what was the advantage to it at that point in time? So that one to me was a PR mistake. Those were kind of that whole search was a disaster on so many levels, Eric. And then I would throw the logo thing in there. It's just kind of a why, you know, I mean, what was the point ultimately?
The ditching the Lady Ball logo was the first thing that immediately jumped to my mind. Cause you talk about just bad moves and bad ideas. That one was it.
And how did you not know what the response was going to be to that?
Yeah.
You had to know what the response was going to be to that. You had
yeah,
to.
Yeah. I mean, and listen, I had a great, and still do have a good relationship with Dave Hart. I think the world of Dave Hart. Dave Hart's, he is one of those ADs though. I mean, man, that guy loved a good fight. I mean, he really did, man. He loved to tangle and mix it up with people. Didn't bother him in the least, whether it was city leaders or going after the logo deal. It did not bother him in the least to get sideways with somebody. He was totally comfortable as an administrator in that scenario. He was not one of those, well, he's really afraid of upsetting somebody. Didn't bother him in any way, shape, or form at all. Relished it in some cases.
Do you think the SEC, Big Ten, and Big 12 would be agreeable to a three-way scheduling setup to prevent all of these blackouts of future games?
No, I don't think the Big Ten and the SEC want to invite anybody else to the party.
No.
I think they want to run college football. I think that's why they've had their own meetings and haven't invited anybody else.
Think the plan is still to add a wide receiver and a defensive back in the transfer portal?
Well, I think DB takes on a totally different deal now. I mean, if the Ricky Gibson situation doesn't get resolved and he is indeed realistically leaving or is going to leave, then yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely going to be in the portal for a defensive back. Just for a body. I mean, you got to go take somebody with some kind of experience there probably. So their outlook of what you're looking for, I mean, you're more desperate, I guess, for a DB in that scenario. Wide receiver, I mean, if the right guy's there, maybe. I mean, I think part of that depends on what these freshmen look like, you know, kind of where you think you are. I don't know that you necessarily have to take a body just to have a warm body. Maybe you do. But I think certainly DB catapults any other position at this point in time for a potential portal addition.
Can anything really be learned from the first four opponents for Tennessee baseball? Yeah, I mean, I think so. You still get to see your pitchers throw out there. You still get to see their movement. You still get to see which freshmen have come in and can, you know, really, really attack the lineup. I mean, I think Levi Clark's a player. I think Jay Abernathy is a player. I think Tanner Franklin is going to help Tennessee in a massive way out of the bullpen. I think Liam Dool's good. Have I been surprised at how dominant he's been in his first two starts? Sure, but do I know that eventually it's going to level out because you're going to play not level out, but it's going to, you know, correct course because you're about to play some stronger competition? Absolutely. I mean, Liam Dool, I still think he's going to be good this year, but he's been flat out dominant his first two starts against teams, one in Hofstra, that literally practiced baseball in a gym before they came down here to Knoxville. So I'm trying to pump the brakes a little bit on stuff like that, but yeah, I think you learn some things. I think you know who's going to be players for you and who's not, and I think Tony's got a lot of them. Tony's got an awful lot.
You don't think Liam Dool is going to strike out 76% of the batters he faces over a how many game season? 75-game season?
I don't.
Are you a hater? You're just a hater, Eric.
Also, and if he doesn't, it's my fault too.
So. I've got something we can all learn about North Alabama. You ready? Who played quarterback there? He took off on Cary Grant. George Lindsay played quarterback in North Alabama.
George Lindsay and John Chavis tied to North Alabama. Who knew?
That's the actor that played Goober, Eric. He was a character on the Andy Griffith Show that was on in the 60s.
It's good to know.
Not to
North Alabama, also a Division II program for a long time up until like 10 years ago.
Don't confuse Goober and Gomer. They're two different guys.
Well, that's good, because I was definitely going to confuse them in my conversations later in the day. That Vol guy, what do you expect to see from Caldwell's Lady Vols for the rest of the season? A lot of folks seem to be tabbing them as one of the most dangerous teams, which is justified, but I'm curious to see what you guys think their ceiling is this year.
I mean, I think they, particularly if they're going to host in the first two rounds, I think they can be a Sweet 16 team, and then after that, it becomes about matchups. I think for them to be there, they've got to stay out of foul trouble, particularly with the bigs. That'll be key Thursday night. Spearman's got to stay out of foul trouble early in that game because of Kentucky's size. And then I think they have to defend better in the fourth quarter. They become a much better third quarter team offensively, which was a real bugaboo to start the year. But the last few games they've won because they have just kind of out-offensed the opponent in the fourth quarter and made enough plays. They need to get some more defensive stops in the fourth quarter to close out games better. I think that's the sort of the next step for them, is when they got somebody down, they got to put games away. They've won these games, but they probably haven't put teams away the way that they needed to. They had a big lead against Alabama, and Alabama crawled back into it, and then they kind of held off Florida by scoring enough points late. So I think they can be better in the fourth quarter as well.
I think the possibility of hosting is a big deal, a huge deal. And I think the style of play and just kind of the it can be tough to prepare for and face if you're not familiar with it, if you haven't seen it before. So if you get through the first two rounds and then you get to the Sweet 16, you get a favorable matchup in terms of a team that maybe you haven't seen before, is not used to that style. It can be tough to get prepared for on a quick turnaround.
Andrew Himmelman, you ready for this question today? Is it going to mix up my weekly question just a little bit? Get rid of one of these items: donuts, chicken fingers, Pop-Tarts, or burgers? Nobody here is getting rid of a burger, so we can move past that. Is it Pop-Tarts, chicken fingers, or donuts?
Wait a minute. Grant, are you getting rid of a burger?
I'm about to get processed into the On3 transfer portal because I'm going to say Pop-Tarts. So Hubs is done with me.
Well, again, you guys know I'm about to have a kid here in a month and a half. So I'm sure chicken fingers are going to be in my repertoire over the next couple of years. But like, I can't remember the last time I've seen a chicken finger, Grant. You have kids. I'm sure you see it all the time.
Well, it's less chicken fingers. It's more dino nuggets out of the freezer in the microwave for a minute. That's right. that you call a dinner. I would get rid of Pop-Tarts. I'll do Andrew one, go a step further here and power rank these. I would go donuts, burgers. Actually, you can combine those if you've ever had the burgers that have donuts for the buns. It's delicious, Eric. Don't knock it till you try it.
I think I just had a heart attack.
Donuts, one, burgers, two, chicken fingers, three, Pop-Tarts, four. I'm sorry, Hubs. I'm not trying to offend. Not trying to lose my job, but just being honest.
I'll jump back into the On3 transfer portal. I'll have donuts last. I'm not a donut guy. Burgers, one, I guess. I mean, I like chicken. I haven't seen chicken fingers in years, but I like chicken. So chicken fingers, two, and then Pop-Tarts, three.
Okay. Yeah. Fine. Whatever. I mean,
we got to hear yours. Come on.
Well, I mean, in terms of advice, I'm putting donuts at the top as a must keep. I am a guy who has been known to, I talk about my donut stop on the way home to Nashville, but I've been known to stop in Farragut and buy a box of Munchkins to put in the passenger seat and just eat them driving down the road, going to Atlanta or wherever. I mean, I can devour.
Throw them up in the air, catch them.
I can devour Munchkins. So donut is a vice, is a big time vice for me. I would probably, as much as I love Pop-Tarts, they would probably be third because I'd probably put a protein in there. I'd probably go, I don't know, maybe burgers too, because you can eat a burger in so many different ways, right? You can have it as basically Salisbury steak with some gravy, or you can have it with steak sauce. You can have it with mustard,
two different worlds.
Ketchup. I mean, we can do all kinds of stuff with a hamburger.
There's a gulf between those two worlds. The best thing about my hot take on burgers is the more plain Jane the burger, the better. I don't need a bougie burger with all these things that cost $20.
You don't need a Joe Retro burger.
Give me the burger, give me the cheese, give me lettuce, give me tomato. I'm good to go. And the best thing about burgers is you can make a better one at home than you can get in most places out in public.
I don't disagree with that. The thing about a burger is if you cook extra burgers and you got leftovers, you can eat that burger in a variety of different ways. It doesn't have to be the same burger the next day. It doesn't have to have egg and all these other crazy things on top of it, but you can eat it in a different variety. It's much more multi-use than a chicken finger is. So I'm going to put a burger up higher than a chicken finger.
It's going to
be last for me.
And I'm going to call Eric Kane's bluff on donuts. If I pull up and the Krispy Kreme hot donut sign's on and I get a dozen, you're not going to eat any of those?
I mean, if I'm like starving, yeah, but I'm not a donut guy. I'm not really a donut guy.
This is it for us, Eric.
That's a crime. No Andy Griffin, no donuts. You're out.
You need a new game day podcast host in the fall. Buddy. I mean, start looking.
It won't be hard to find another. I was at the local Cracker Barrel.
Ouch.
Holy smokes.
I was at the local Cracker Barrel earlier this week, and they did away with hamburger steaks, and I was genuinely upset because I love that meal. And yeah, talking about burger and burger's versatility.
This is the three-person standoff where I got a gun at Hubs over Pop-Tarts and at Eric over donuts, and we're all just standing here.
I'm just going to go with you on the donut deal, and we're just going to take Eric out. Is what's
okay,
gonna happen.
All right. That's fair.
The A-Dog. What's the plan that Jermon McCoy has a setback in his recovery? I'm not sure if he wrote this before or after the Ricky Gibson news, but some young guys got to step up, and they got to go find one in the transfer portal, Brett.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see. I think that's the million-dollar question right now and what it looks like in the secondary. I mean, does a guy like, I don't think you want to move Boo Carter from the nickel spot. He could certainly slide out and play corner, but who would be your nickel there? I mean, they've just got to build some depth, and those young guys have to show up in spring practice. So we'll see how those young guys look in spring ball and then see what they can get done in the portal.
Got a couple. We got three more, and they're all good, so I want to get to them. This is from Z-Vols. What do you think this baseball coaching staff will look like in 2 years? Do you expect Tony to maintain the level of success when Frank and Josh have moved on? That being Josh Elander, who's going to be a head coach. He could have been a head coach last offseason, in my opinion. Frank Anderson, of course, pitching coach. That's a great question because so much of what Tony has done here at Tennessee is because of those two guys and the rest of his staff. He has been so – I mean, he's the head coach, but, I mean, Frank Anderson runs the staff in terms of the pitching staff. Tony's very hands-off in that regard. Josh Reynolds, former pitching coach at Cincinnati, has joined the staff, support staff role. One would believe that he's kind of sitting there learning and watching Frank and all that, and if Frank were to retire whenever that happens, you could slide him over. We'll have to see. But the way Tony recruits and the way Tony connects and his locker room guy and all that, I mean, what could the staff look like in 2 years? I certainly think there could be some changes, but I think the success is going to follow Tony Vitello, in my opinion. If you had to rank, this is from WHC, if you had to rank the top five quarterbacks you're most confident in going into 2025, who would they be? Grant, have you given this some thought?
I don't know about what order I would rank them in. I thought more of just a grouping of some of the guys. I mean, Garrett Nussmeier, right, at LSU.
Absolutely.
Lenore Sellers, South Carolina. DJ Lagway, Florida, with the way Florida closed last season. Diego Pavia, he is back, right? He did get his stuff approved. Nico's in that conversation, obviously. You'd expect Arch Manning to probably be in that conversation. John Mateer going to Oklahoma. That's probably another good one. I don't know how those guys rank, but those feel like some of the biggest names that just jumped out to me right away.
Yeah, I'm fascinated to see the second-year development of Lagway and Sellers because of the dynamics that they can create. I think at Texas, there's going to be a lot of Texas fans who are going to ask the question, why didn't Arch Manning play in the playoffs? Why didn't he get a series? Why didn't he get some – why didn't you use him as some kind of a weapon in the playoff run? Because I think Arch Manning is going to be a good player at Texas. I really do. I think there's going to be a lot of people at Texas kind of wonder why he disappeared at the end of the season in terms of playing time.
I think DJ Lagway is going to be really good, but also he threw 9 picks in limited time last year. So it's like let's not try to cover all the warts there. He had a turnover issue, in my opinion. So all these lists about him being a top 3 quarterback in the country in the SEC, like let's pump the brakes a little bit. The conversation starts with Sellers and Nussmeier, 100%. Nussmeier is probably number one for me. And Nico is absolutely in that conversation for me because I've seen him do it. I know he's got to take a step. But I would have Nico in there with Lagway, Manning, Nussmeier, and Sellers. Pavia would be kind of that next man out, in my opinion. All right, last one. This will be fun. S-Pit Vol. This is a difficult question, but who are your top 3 Vol signal callers of all time? My list, the posters list, is Peyton Manning, Heath Shuler, Hendon Hooker. Honorable mentions, Casey Clawson, Josh Dobbs, and T. Martin.
He's young. The poster here is young, because if Kondrej Holloway is not on that list, then you don't have a list. I think Kondrej Holloway, because of the dynamics and what he brought to the table, I think he has to be mentioned. And I mean, he's not even listed as an honorable mention, which he should be. So he's got to be factored into that conversation. I think this is hard. Once you get past Peyton, Grant, I think this becomes an interesting debate, because you're talking about very different eras of football and very different styles of play. So, you know, were you factoring in numbers, not numbers, and all those types of things is interesting. I'd probably hold Casey Clawson in a higher regard than a lot of other people, even though he wasn't physically the most dynamic guy. He was a winner. He was accurate with the football. I think he was an underappreciated Vol when he was here. And I think he's a little bit of a forgotten Vol as you get further away from him. I think Casey Clawson was a really good quarterback, really good college quarterback at Tennessee. Really good.
If the poster is young, I'm probably younger, because I'm not old enough to fully appreciate Heath Shuler and I know how good he was, but I don't know how good he was in that era and what it was like to watch him week in and week out and kind of all that stuff and everything around him. Obviously, Peyton is on there. Kondrej is on there. I think T. Martin has to kind of get more discussion there, because he played the most important position on the field for the most important season in Tennessee football since when? 1950-something. 1951, probably. I mean, they went 13-0. They won a national championship. They didn't do it just because of the quarterback. He wasn't the best player on the field or anything like that, but he played the biggest position on the field, most important, and he played it at a level at which he took his team to a national championship, and it's hard to argue with that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's all, you know, how you define the list as the poster. I mean, from a talent standpoint, I mean, Brent, call me out here. I mean, T. Martin's probably the bottom of the list of all these guys we've even mentioned so far, right? I mean, but he was good enough to win you a national championship with a really, really good team. My list absolutely was Peyton Manning. I had Heath Shuler on there for sure. Then I probably will have Kondrej on there. The Iceman, probably one of the top honorable mentions just because of what he did here at Tennessee. But that's very much an impossible task, yeah, because there have been so many great quarterbacks here at the University of Tennessee.
The interesting thing about Heath, quickly, and I know we're running out of time, the interesting thing about Heath is his game would translate so much better now than it did back then.
Oh yeah,
because of how the game is played and how it's open. So,
and the athlete that he was.
Yeah, the athlete that he was, the size that he played with, the arm strength he had. I mean, he in this day and age, he would be absolutely. I mean, he was highly sought after and wanted by everybody coming out of high school. But I mean, he would be a poster child for it right now with the way teams are playing football. You know, I look at a guy like Josh Dobbs and what he did to help bring Tennessee back through a period where it was ugly. I mean, you know, it's an impossible question to answer outside of Peyton. Peyton's clearly number one. And then after that, you can discuss who the rest of those guys should be. And there's valid points for all of those guys on there, which makes it fun. That's why it's a debate that's, you know, there is no right or wrong answer to. It's kind of your era, what you remember, you know, and those types of things certainly factor in there more than just the raw numbers of it all.
My T. Martin soapbox is they didn't win every game by 21 points. Like, they were almost done at Syracuse to open the season. They had to beat Florida in overtime. They were dead and buried against Arkansas in the fourth quarter. And I know he didn't exactly. They ran the ball down the field to beat Arkansas after they got that fumble, and that's not T. Martin. But still, winning close games and winning a championship is a huge deal.
One of the worst chewings I've ever witnessed in my life was David Cutcliffe and T. Barton in Sanford Stadium in Athens, Georgia. Coach's booth near the broadcast booth, and T. was bad in the first half of that game. Missed some open throws, and I mean, David Cutcliffe was on the phone and absolutely lost his mind, like just lost his mind. And for whatever reason, it was like a light switch flipped from that point. And if you go look, T, right at the end of the first half, threw a touchdown pass to Cedric Wilson and just a straight little wide receiver screen, and he dove in for a touchdown. And he finished that game playing really well. Then he goes to South Carolina, and like, it's Captain Accurate all of a sudden and doesn't miss anything. And then he makes money play in the championship game with two deep throws against Mississippi State to come from behind to win that game. It was like a real line in the sand moment in Athens, Georgia, late in the second quarter with David Cutcliffe and T. Martin, that for whatever reason, it changed. And from that point on, the numbers bear it out. I mean, T was a much more productive player after that moment in Athens, Georgia. It's one of the craziest things I witnessed firsthand.
I just remember everybody going into that game picking Georgia.
Yeah, they just lost
I think
Jamal.
Game day was yeah. maybe there or something. I don't know.
They had Quincy Carter, you know.
Right, right. I was 10 years old at the time, but I just remember everybody picking Georgia. What was it, 17-9 or something? It wasn't a yeah.
Al Wilson's leaning over in the A gap and he's barking. He's literally giving the bulldog bark pre-snap. Cozy Coleman. I mean, there's a bunch of Georgia kids on that team. Okay. Cozy Coleman post-game on the field looked at me and I said, "When did you know it was over?" He goes, "They quit in the third quarter. You saw the quit in all their eyes. They didn't want any more in the third quarter. You could see it." Fulmer called it a program win after the game, threw his hat in the stand, praised Judy Jackson. Rodney Garner had assembled. He wasn't here to enjoy it, but he had assembled Deion Grant and Fred Weary and Cozy Coleman, and of course Jamal was out. That was a big time win because everybody had written Tennessee off in that game after the injury to Jamal Lewis, and they were bad at Auburn. T was bad at Auburn; did not play very well at all. They needed that fourth down stop at Auburn at the goal line to survive that game. So you just assume they're in trouble here. And they just manhandled Georgia on that defensive front seven for the entire game. I mean, Quincy Carter had to be seeing 18 orange shirts coming at him every play because they were relentless. It was crazy.
Hubs was on the field, and meanwhile, I had New Sentinel sports pages taped to my bedroom wall. One of them had a headline that said, "Foes don't get cozy with Cozy." That's the one I remember.
He dead looked at me, and he was stern. He was angry about it. It was like, "When did you know?" He goes, "They quit in the third quarter. They didn't want any more of it. They were done." It's like, "All righty then. Here we go. This is fun."
Kids, those are the best sound bites right after the game on the field. Just go put a camera in someone's face or a mic and just let it roll.
Yeah, I mean, you had not seen a whole lot out of Travis Stevens and Travis Henry to that point because it had been the Jamal show. Because what Jamal had done at the end of 97 and then what he did – I mean, Jamal was a man-child in that Florida game in 98. They just kept feeding him. He just kept getting pummeled. And it was him and Sean Bryson. You kind of thought, okay, well, there's a huge drop-off here at tailback. What are we going to see? Little did you know how good, you know, Travis Henry was and how productive he was. And you know, those two guys went for 100 yards in that game against Georgia and their first real playing time. I mean, meaningful game on the line type deal. Those two guys rushed for 100 yards. I mean, Tennessee just whipped them in the line of scrimmage. Just beat them up and down for 60 minutes from start to finish.
I look forward to the book, Brent. Can't wait for you to write your book. I'm going to read it.
That was a fun season. That was a fun game to cover. I mean, it really was because that was a true statement, like plant the flag. We're here. Like we weren't just about Peyton Manning for 4 years. Like we are a legitimate program from top to bottom. We have planted our flag in this league. You're going to have to deal with us. We've beaten Florida on a day where you counted us out because we quote lost our best player. We just beat your brains in, and we have planted the flag that we're here to stay.
Good times in Tennessee football history. Hopefully many more to come, and we'll have it all covered one way or the other right here at VolQuest.com. Basketball season happening right now. The race to the end of the regular season. Some big matchups coming. Saturday's game, massive against Alabama in terms of seeding purposes in the NCAA tournament. Tennessee football picked up a commit earlier this week. Tennessee baseball is happening. Going to be in Houston this weekend. Going to have coverage of all that and more every single day this week right over on the General's Quarters and at VolQuest.com. Big thanks, as always, to Exterior Home Solution for being the proud presenting sponsor of the show, 865-524-5888, or online at ExteriorHomeSolutions.com. They have been local and trusted since 1999. That is Exterior Home Solutions. For Grant Ramey, Brent Hubbs, I'm Eric Kane. This has been the VolQuest Mailbag Podcast here on a Thursday morning.
You've been listening to the VolQuest Mailbag Podcast every week, right here on VolQuest.